If you've been sitting at home wishing there were some way you could help, you are not alone. All this week, we've been hearing from people who want to find some way to be useful during this pandemic, and others who have ideas to share. Some are donating canned goods to food banks, others sewing face masks. Lawyers are offering webinars. Main companies are shifting gears to produce personal protective equipment for hospitals, and ingenuity is everywhere. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will dedicate 2 hours to a discussion about ways to help, from supporting a local business or nonprofit, to donating blood, to calling friends and family who live alone. What ideas do you have? What do you need? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. One of the brighter sides of the COVID-19 pandemic is the spirit of giving that emerges in times of crisis. Today, we'll find out how people across Maine are finding ways to help each other and the community, and we'll learn what you can do to volunteer or offer support to others in these difficult times. Today's show is another 2-hour conversation as we cover the impacts of the coronavirus on our state. Joining me this hour, Aaron Fogg, Vice President of Development and Communications with Good Shepherd Food Bank, and Mary Alice Crofton, Executive Director of Volunteer Maine. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you have a story to share about neighbor helping neighbor, or what some businesses are doing to help others? Are you looking to volunteer or do something to help during this crisis? Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Aaron, I'm going to start with you, calling from Good Shepherd Food Bank. Who are you all finding is in most need right now, and how are you prioritizing what you're doing?
Thanks, Jennifer. Yeah, it's a great question. These are certainly unprecedented times for the food bank. We're used to, on a daily basis, helping so many of our neighbors across the state and working with our partners, our food pantries and meal sites to help those who are struggling with hunger or aren't quite sure where their next meal will come from. You know, we're used to doing that work every day. And now we're just seeing that the need is greater than ever. You know, more than 200,000 Maine families each year rely on the Charitable Food Network. And we know that during this time, when jobs are limited, schools are closed, families are just experiencing more pressure than ever. And so we actually saw last week, it was about a 500% increase on the number of page views on our Find Food section of our website. So that just reaffirms for us, although we don't know the numbers out in every community just yet, it really reaffirms what we're feeling as people are worried about food right now, and they're wondering where it's going to come from.
Yeah, I know that you really depend on volunteers throughout the year. What about right now? What kind of help is most needed? Do you need volunteers, or do you need some other kind of help?
Yeah, so we part of our response in the past week or so has been to pivot. Our normal distribution model is getting pallets of food out to food pantries for them to display and let clients come in to shop. And what we're doing right now is pivoting in a way that we are going to start packing emergency food boxes and getting those out to pantries so that their job is as easy as possible to be able to take a box of food that comes in and get it to someone in need. Normally, we do rely on a really big crew of volunteers. The volunteer hours each year kind of equates to 10 full-time employees, so it's substantial for us. And although we're taking volunteers on a limited basis right now, we're working with a pretty skeleton crew. So, in your topic here of what unique things people are doing to help, we can really highlight that L.L. Bean has stepped up to help us pack these food boxes. And just this week, an L.L. Bean truck showed up at the food bank. We loaded food in, food that we've purchased for these emergency food boxes, and L.L. Bean brought that back to their fulfillment center, and employees there packed the food up for us, and we got our first round of boxes back just yesterday, and more work is underway. So in the absence of volunteers right now, L.L. Bean as a company has really stepped up to help us out.
And that's just wonderful. We're going to hear from L.L. Bean in the second hour of this program. Mary Alice, I want to turn to you. What volunteer organizations have been actively seeking people to help during this crisis? What that you know of?
So there are kind of a convergence of two things that are going on in terms of organizations that are looking for additional assistance. We've heard from the Red Cross, and we're in a sense hearing from organizations whose volunteers have typically been in the retiree group or older, who now are needing to not be out in the public, and we've heard from some other organizations, but more what we're hearing is that the organizations that use volunteers on a regular basis to deliver services in the community need this initial period of time to rethink how they work, because they need to be sure that all of those safety protocols about distance and lack of contact and, you know, all the protections, not just for the people who come in to be served, but the volunteers themselves, can be respected. And so at the same time, there's a huge surge of folks who want to help. The volunteer organizations are also looking at, how can we reshape what we do? And that just takes some thinking time, because, of course, they can't jettison their normal onboarding of volunteers. It would create a second disaster.
Right. So if it's a circumstance, it's a nonprofit that will maybe have a volunteer day where they will have a whole group of people come together, that's not going to be something that can be done right now. I understand that. So is your advice, Mary Alice, if you either are a regular volunteer at an organization or are interested in volunteering, to sort of reach out at this point by email or by phone and let this organization know you're available, but not really expect to be tapped right away?
So several things. One of which is to for everybody to look at the UnitedWaysOfMaine.org volunteer section, where for years local community organizations have been able to list their volunteer opportunities at no cost. And we've been working with the United Ways and the Maine VOED organizations, which VOED is for Volunteer Organizations Active in Disaster, to label those things that are COVID-19 specific so that they can be spotted really quickly. So that is, you know, if you want to volunteer, if you're living in Brewer and as furthest you want to go is Old Town or Milford, use that for a search. The second thing is for folks to remember that this, as the governor likes to say, is a marathon and not a sprint. And so there's going to be a need for volunteers over a longer period of time, especially as I know of some organizations, especially those that deliver meals or start up for a different set of services in the summer or those sorts of things. Many of them have engaged the part-time residents as volunteers, and those people may not be able to come back or may not be able to be out in the public. So registering your interest now, but thinking about in May, in June, in July, what would I want to be doing, and then being patient with the organization as it gets its onboarding process into place. Silence should There shouldn't be silence, but everybody's under pressure at the moment. In the normal time, they would have gotten something back. But if there's a little delay in somebody reaching back and saying, hey, we're really glad you're going to volunteer with us, and here's what we need you to do because we need to know you better in order to be sure that we take advantage of your skills, to understand that's a normal part of the volunteer world.
Yeah. Erin, I understand that many of the people who volunteer at Good Shepherd are retired, and I'm certain that you're asking them not to come in. Are you looking for younger people to, as Mary Alice says, this is a marathon, not a sprint, to come in to think about Good Shepherd who might not have before?
Absolutely. We're hoping people think of Good Shepherd Food Bank, but also all of those local community organizations that make up the Charitable Food Network. So we work with about 450 partners statewide, including schools, which are now closed, of course, but traditional food pantries and meal sites. And people who are looking to volunteer, I think, you know, our name is out there about hunger relief in the community, so they might think of us first, but perhaps the best way they could help is to find out what those local community needs are. Do meals need to be delivered? Do pantries need some of that food and toilet paper that's being hidden in people's pantries right now? You know, really reaching out locally to see what those community organizations need, I think makes a lot of sense.
Joining us on the line now is Hannah Pingree. She is Director of the Governor's Office of Policy Innovation and the Future. Thanks so much for calling in, Hannah.
Hey, Jennifer. Good to be here.
The state has a brand new resource for people on ways to help in Maine. Tell us about that website that just launched this morning.
Sure. I mean, the governor, you know, was out there today expressing her condolences for the first corona death in Maine. And so it's a rough day for Mainers that we knew this was coming. But I think she was very clear in an early message about how much Mainers want to help. And I have been helping to field emails, as have many other people in state government, from folks all over Maine who are saying, Governor, I'm with you. We're concerned. You know, we're stuck at home. How can we help? So we launched a website, coronavirus.maine.gov/mainehelps. And it's really to direct people a little more quickly to some of the ways we think people in Maine can help. And I know you're talking today to lots of different people who run amazing and important organizations that are helping in so many ways. So the governor is encouraging to consider giving to some of the larger statewide organizations. The Maine Community Foundation has set up a COVID relief fund, as have the United Ways. There are nine regional United Ways that are doing amazing work. And we're engaged in these organizations because we know they're helping to serve sort of the urgent and human needs, from food, supporting the Good Shepherd Food Bank, who you were just speaking with, to senior organizations, to the homeless shelters. So it's really kind of about the urgent human needs right now. So we're going to continue to update this website to show other ways Maine people can help. Volunteering is complicated, but we will put volunteer opportunities as they are safe and available, especially remote ones. We have a site for medical providers who want to step up and help. We know that will be needed in the coming days, so there's an opportunity for that, as well as a couple of different forms folks can fill out. We've been getting offers of donations, of face masks, of willingness to sew, of willingness to figure out how to manufacture. So we're trying to channel those and make sure we respond to people as quickly as possible who want to help. So all of that is online. Again, we're just trying to make sure we can hear from people and respond to them as quickly as possible. And again, the exciting thing is we are hearing about so many amazing and great ways that people in Maine are stepping up, trying to help their neighbors, both virtually, in person, through, you know, ingenuity. You know, the Maine Seacoast Mission has figured out how to do a drive-through food pantry to help with social distancing. So, you know, I know you're hearing those stories from all over Maine. The governor is incredibly impressed and inspired, and unfortunately, we're going to need a lot more of this in the coming days.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. That is Hannah Pingree. She heads the State Office of Policy Innovation in the Future. We have already posted a link to the state's new website on our Facebook page and also on the Maine Calling webpage. Hannah, thanks so much for calling in.
Great. Thanks, Jennifer.
I want to turn back to you, Aaron, from Good Shepherd. We've all seen the pictures of grocery store shelves that are empty. Are you, is Good Shepherd, having trouble getting enough food?
You know, so normally we rely on retailers for the majority of the food that we distribute. About 70% of the 25 million meals we distribute each year comes from retail donations. And like you just said, those grocery store shelves are pretty slim pickings. And so there's not as much food being donated to the food bank at this time. And I know firsthand, talking with Hannaford, which is one of our largest supporters, it really hurts for them to feel like there isn't as much food coming to us. And they're thinking about as many different ways as they can help, including asking for donations at registers to help support what we now need to do, which is purchasing food. We do purchase food throughout the year to supplement donations. But right now, we've just last Friday, we placed an order of several truckloads of shelf-stable food. We've also purchased some main crops, potatoes and apples, that have been in storage and can be distributed. And that's the food that we'll be pushing out over the next few weeks. And all of that food is going out to the communities that we support, those food pantries, at no cost. It's going directly to them to help them feed the neighbors there.
Mary Alice, we've just heard Aaron describing how the Good Shepherd Food Bank is sort of rethinking the way that they do things. Is that your advice to other nonprofits, other organizations, as we go into this stretch that you describe as a marathon, to step back and do some rethinking?
Yes, and you know, there's two ways for the also for the public to think about it. Remember the neighboring part of things. But in those services that have got to resume and be available to the public and the clients and the folks who are within their territories, it is time for creative thinking. Think about, for instance, some of the organizations have volunteer needs that folks can't see, which can be really frustrating to the person who is in a position to get involved now. Being sure that those get posted online. But usually the reason it's not visible through one of those United Way platforms is that the person is so focused on delivering services to the community that doing this more administrative work of posting something in a website can feel like, you know, it's not that important. So think about, can you pull in somebody who maybe is more comfortable with that in order to keep your needs out in front of folks? And as the volume, I talked to a couple of managers of volunteers, because we've been looking to redeploy the AmeriCorps members in the state as the schools and their sites have shut. And in talking with them, they're like, oh, we can't manage one more person. So maybe it's time to think about who are the folks who are approaching you who have management skills that you could, as a volunteer team leader, put in charge of a set of volunteers, and that increases your capacity to meet the demands of the community. So some of it is finding that time with your coffee in the morning or your tea to think, how could I do this differently? And are there things in my agency that I need to float now, that it's also an opportunity for us to say, okay, we thought we would do this somewhere down the road. We need to do it now.
We're going to take a quick break. This is a special 2-hour Maine Calling program about ways to help one another. When we come back, we will have your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Major support of Maine Calling's special coverage is provided by Modern Pest Services, now featuring the Anti-CMEX Smart Pest Control System for your home. Learn more at modernpest.com. And Maine Community Foundation, proud to support Maine Calling, a forum for ideas and issues that matter most. MaineCF.org.
The people who pick America's food face two big challenges in this pandemic: tight border controls and tight living conditions that make social distancing almost impossible.
You know, as testing becomes more available, farm workers should probably be part of the priority.
I'm Ari Shapiro. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And All Things Considered is today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. The Maine Center for Disease Control holds a daily weekday update and briefing on the coronavirus for the citizens of Maine. You can watch it in its entirety on Maine Public Television, on our website, mainepublic.org, and on the Maine Public Facebook page. We'll let you know here what time the briefing is scheduled for when we know. Again, the daily briefing on the coronavirus from the Maine CDC can be seen on Maine Public Television, on our website, mainepublic.org, and also on the Maine Public Facebook page. They will also be archived each day for later viewing. Please visit mainepublic.org and click on the television dropdown.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are dedicating our two-hour show today to highlighting ways people are helping each other during this time of need and learning about opportunities to volunteer. My guests are Mary Alice Crofton with Volunteer Maine and Aaron Fogg with the Good Shepherd Food Bank. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us now is Chris Hall. She works at the University of New England and is a costumer, designer, and stitcher, and she's helping to coordinate efforts to make homemade masks. Thanks so much for calling in, Chris.
Thank you for having me.
We have heard, and I've seen on my social media, that just about everyone who can sew in Maine is making homemade masks as protective gear. What are you doing about this surge of people wanting to donate these masks?
Well, it certainly has been a surge. There are about six of us who started out separately with two Facebook groups and a sewing shop website. And we are working together now to coordinate the over 1,000 stitchers and over 40 area coordinators for the counties to create drop points for supplies and to deliver finished masks to the healthcare organizations that are requesting them directly from us now through our system.
How are you offering people guidelines on what kind of mask is best to make?
Well, that is the trickiest question of them all, and I've been furiously working on a tutorial for a very simple mask this morning with the team. What we would love is an official guidance from a consortium of hospitals saying this is the homemade mask that we all could use for most purposes, and then we would make those. But what we're finding is the requests we're getting are all different, and some of them are more complicated than others. Right now we have 1,000 stitchers. If each one of them can make 5 masks, that's 5,000 masks. But if each one can make 50 masks, that's quite a bit different. And that's what we would like to do to get them in the hands of anyone who wants them.
All right. And what do you plan to do with the masks? How are you going to get them to whoever wants them?
We have connections individually with the healthcare organizations that have reached out to us. So we have an official connection at each organization. And we've been dropping them in baskets outside of the organization so that we're practicing appropriate social distancing. And some things have been mailed back and forth between people. So we don't have any trouble getting the masks where they need to be because of our organization. We just need to know what kind of masks people want.
Chris, how can people get involved? You say you have about 1,000 now. How about 2,000?
We'd love to have 2,000. We'd love for you, if your Facebook is your thing, to go to Sewing Masks for Maine, which is a Facebook group that has about 250 now, but all together we have 1,000 or so volunteers amongst the six of us who have been working on this. Or you can go directly to facemaskforMaine.wixsite.com, and fill out the form there, and we'll get in touch with you.
Well, thanks so much for calling in, Chris. That's Chris Hall. She is helping to coordinate the grassroots effort to donate homemade masks. As you heard, already 1,000 stitchers involved. On the line now, Kate Carlisle, Director of Public Relations and Community Affairs for Central Maine Healthcare. Thanks for calling in, Kate.
Hi, Jennifer.
You just heard Chris. Yeah, you just heard Chris talking about the deluge of people making masks. I know that the Maine CDC and Maine Health have both cautioned people that they are prioritizing professional grade masks right now. What is Central Maine Healthcare's stance on the enthusiastic face mask sewers around Maine?
Well, we have also been incredibly lucky to be deluged, as you say, with offers to help in this public health emergency. And we have had a lot of offers from local crafters and sewists and stitchers in Lewiston, Auburn, and other areas in central Maine. And we happily will take donations of fabric masks because they are completely, usually made of cotton fabric. They do not supply the type of protection that our clinical staff would need for example, working with a COVID-19 patient when there is close contact. And we know that this disease is spread by respiratory droplets. So the best masks for those kind of procedures and for clinical staff are the N95 respirator masks, which are in short supply nationwide. But one way that we've decided and our risk and infection prevention teams have discovered is that the cotton fabric masks can provide excellent extra coverage over other masks and would allow those other masks to extend their usable life. And that is, although the N95s are meant to be disposable, this would give them a little bit extra time. So we happily would accept donations of fabric masks. I would say one of the things our infection preventionists have come up with is that it's even better if these homemade masks are stitched out of waterproof fabric. One of our nurses created a prototype stitched out of surgical drape, which looked like it would actually do a great job of preventing unwitting transmission. Again, not as good as an N95 mask, but definitely something that could be used by either non-clinical or non-patient facing people in the hospital.
What are some other ways people are offering to help you and your healthcare providers?
Well, we have just been overwhelmed by the way the communities we serve have stepped up. Local distillers and makers of delicious alcohol products have changed their productions and produced an awful lot of pure alcohol and ethanol, which combined with efforts from the University of Maine have resulted in gallons and gallons, 300 gallons of hand sanitizer for Central Maine Healthcare, something else that we were in short supply of. Boston Brands, the Sazerac Company is one of those. New England Distilling, which is in Portland, is another. Bates College, our neighbor down the street in Lewiston, has really stepped up and offered their 3D printers as well as their experts, computer science and design thinking faculty, to start to create really great things on the 3D printer, including face shields, another really important personal protective piece of gear, which are meant to be disposable, but they're simply plastic face shields that clinicians can wear when examining patients. A lot of our local school departments have also offered their 3D printing capabilities to create this type of thing. So it's been really gratifying.
All right. Well, Kate, thank you so much for calling in, and good luck to all of you. Kate Carlisle, Head of Community Affairs for Central Maine Healthcare. Appreciate you calling in. We're going to go to Teresa calling from Cumberland. Hi, Teresa. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hello, Jennifer. Thank you for all the good work you're doing and to your team for bringing kind of these wonderful, innovative ways of getting us through this tricky time. So I call because I'm a semi-retired first grade teacher of 33 years and do elder care now. And so I'm in a different sort of place. in my career. But my love for literacy is super strong. And so when I was trying to figure out what I could do in a small way to make a difference, I was thinking about the written word and poetry and just homemade cards and writing letters. So ever since this has been going on for weeks now, I've been making an enormous effort of going by Trader Joe, the dollar store, or making homemade cards and writing a love letter, two or three a day, to people in my family, to the retirement home where I work with Sweethearts with Dementia, to previous students, seniors in my community and my family. And so I tried at least three times a day when, you know, having morning coffee or tea that was just mentioned, to write a love letter on pretty stationery with a piece of poetry and a little tea bag. And I send out these letters and I seal them with a sponge so I'm not spreading further germs. But just to reach out to people and to say you're remembered and you're loved and you're seen, and to remind them that the written word is so important in this day and age of technology. It's just so nice to get a handwritten letter in the mail with a piece of poetry. I've been putting in a beautiful Native American prayer, a blessing, or I've been putting in the poem Desiderata. And people call and say what a difference it is to not receive a bill in the mail, but to receive some love. So I'm going to continue to do this three or more a day until we see this, you know, virus walk out the door. So
well, Teresa, thank you so much for calling in. And I know you waited for a while on hold to make that comment. We really appreciate it. Mary Alice, I want to turn to you. Do you know of any efforts right now? I know that there are a lot of people who want to be able to reach out to those who may be alone in their homes, maybe with a letter or an email or a phone call. Is there anything underway that you know of to connect people to one another?
The things that I've heard about are around mentoring, that where suddenly the mentors can't meet with the young people anymore. And there's one program in Belfast, for instance, where they're accepting postcards. Obviously, they can't share the addresses of, you know, exactly where the child lives. So they are acting sort of as the middle broker between the mentor so that there's written material for the same reason. Get something in the mail, which for a young person could be really unusual. It's not coming in by text, and send it on to them. There are also some phone reassurance programming that's going on. For instance, in the Skowhegan Central Maine area, the Retired Senior Volunteer Program that's operated by Catholic Charities has upped their phone reassurance program. And there are other organizations that are setting those up as well. So those folks who have the lists, so to speak, have been ramping up the outreach. And I expect that others are going to, as they look at the population that they've been working with, as the community that they're working in, and they figure out what happens when, you know, folks can't be together in a center, a youth center, a senior center, wherever it might be, that they will begin to set up ways for folks to still get in touch with each other.
I'm going to go to a tweet from Martin. Volunteering this morning at Seeds of Hope Neighborhood Center in Biddeford. Yeah. Packing breakfast to go. Steady stream of hungry people. We served coffee, bagels, orange juice, and hard-boiled eggs, plus extra sandwiches for the weekend. We need volunteers next week. This is what you're talking about, right, Erin?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's amazing what our communities are doing. You know, Hannah mentioned the Maine Seacoast Mission doing a drive-through food pantry. The innovating that's happening on the ground for these frontline workers and volunteers, mostly in the charitable food world, it's really impressive. And I think when folks are thinking about those thank you notes, and we've seen the great show of support with signs at medical centers, and thank you notes being given to grocery store associates, I would encourage folks to think about those organizations in your community that are providing emergency food relief, and maybe send some of those signs or thank you notes or emails their way. I know the team at Good Shepherd Food Bank, who is reporting to our distribution centers each day to continue to get food out, they need encouragement and some good thoughts sent their way as well. Those essential workers on the front line are making all of this happen.
I have an email here from Mary. There's a great pull-together spirit in a time of crisis developing, and many people and groups on Facebook offering to help each other. And surely there are big and specific needs for volunteers. Yet, I don't want to inadvertently add to the spread of the virus or bring it home by being out and about unsafely. And I wonder, being over 60, whether I should leave it to younger people to volunteer, since if I do get sick, I'd be more likely to add to the hospital burden. Who should volunteer, informally and formally? How can they do it safely? Are there organizations who are able to help coordinate volunteers? How do we harness our full pull-together spirit to help flatten the curve? These are the big questions, aren't they, Mary Alice?
They are definitely the big questions, and it's partly why we've been working behind the scenes with the organizations that are running programs on the ground. To say, for that very reason, instead of having somebody walk through your door or whatever, you know, make yourself visible to them, because we are hearing, for instance, from one of the area agencies on aging in Central Maine that if they have swapped some Medicare, I don't want to call it counseling, but they've sort of got a service that used to be in person that they're putting into a virtual call-in, and as they transition that, they're offering an opportunity for more people to get involved with things. I think one of the things that we need to remember is locally in your neighborhood, this idea of neighboring and keeping an eye out. I had a conversation with a new neighbor across the street from me last night, where she noticed a house that nothing has been going on for a few days, and she got to be worried about them. And although we were hollering across the road at each other, you know, did manage to reassure her. I knew what was going on and they were okay. Those sorts of things also need to happen. We can keep our distance and not lose our connections with each other. And as more of the organizations providing services, I'm sure that the tax folks, cash program, a number of others that would be gearing up in this season are going to figure out how to do this through a call-in or through setting up links through Zoom or through Skype or any number of other things, how to do this then and make that visible to folks so that they can get involved and do it in a safe way.
Well, we are going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments. You're listening to a special two-hour Maine Calling. We are talking about ways to help during this crisis. We'll be right back.
Major support of Maine Calling's special coverage is provided by Evergreen Home Performance, dedicated to helping homeowners qualify for Efficiency Maine energy audit and insulation rebates. More at evergreenyourhome.com. On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
Nearly 300 Maine potato growers dumped potatoes at 9 Maine New Brunswick border crossings at dawn on March 27, 1980, to blockade Canadian potatoes from entering the United States. Maine growers said they couldn't compete with the lower Canadian potato prices, and they issued an ultimatum to the U.S. Commerce Department to ban foreign potatoes. On the 29th, the blockade was lifted after the federal government promised to listen to the farmers' grievances.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Roosevelt Campobello International Park and the Island Institute. Happy birthday, Maine! There's a wonderful world of learning alive and well, great for making good use of time at home for students of all ages at mainepublic.org. It's called PBS Learning Media, and the offerings are diverse and interesting. For example, you can learn if those crows that are waking you up are as super smart as you may have heard. And you can learn about the common wood frog that will soon be everywhere, but how do they survive the cold winter? PBS Learning Media is a free, on-demand, online media service for grades K through 12 and for curious adults. For more information or to check it out, go to mainpublic.org, click on the Education drop-down.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we're talking about the many ways that people are finding ways to help during this time of need. Join our conversation. The phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Joining us on the line now is James Morin. He is COO and President of Sales for Flowfold. Thanks for calling in, James.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us what Flowfold usually makes and how you've pivoted in response to the crisis.
Well, normally, and obviously these are not anywhere remotely normal times, but normally we make everyday travel accessories, wallets, backpacks, duffel bags, and we sell them directly to consumers and then also to large retail accounts like L.L. Bean, Urban Outfitters, Duluth. So we are normally making those, and now obviously we've had to shift here a little bit.
What are you making now?
Well, what we're making right now is we've shifted to making protective face shields in response to the shortages that are the result of the COVID-19 pandemic.
How did you figure out what your company could best make with the facilities you have, with the expertise of your employees and the materials you have?
It's a good point. So the first thing that we did was just sent an email out. I believe it was probably on the 15th or 16th of March. So 11 days ago, we sent an email to Maine Health and we said, what do you need? We're going to have some capacity here and we want to be able to help. So what are you like extra short of that we might be able to make? And they sent us a catalog, and they basically said, we're going to need all of it. And we looked through it, and we figured out, based on our technical cutting equipment, based on our expertise of dealing with really difficult materials like sailcloth and other recycled PETs, we quickly realized that the face shield was the easiest and most efficient thing for us to be able to get to hospitals quickly. We wish we could make N95 masks and respirators, but we're going to leave that to the experts, Amazon, Google, Dyson, the people that have millions of dollars. We're just a group of eight people who are really, really hungry to help our community.
Great. How many shields have you made, and are any of them in use yet?
Yeah, the first order of face shields went out to Maine Health, shipped out yesterday, so they're going to be arriving today. That was an order of 1,000, and we have another order of 2,000 that we're actively working on now and into the weekend. That's for Northern Lights, which is formerly Mercy, and a couple of smaller orders too. I mean, we're sending the minimum right now is 100 because we need to build in efficiencies. The amount of orders that we have right now is overwhelming. So the minimum order is 100, but we're shipping 100 to local EMTs, local nursing homes, whoever needs them to be able to protect their patients and themselves. We're shipping them out.
Wow. Well, thanks so much for calling in, James. James Morin, COO and President of Sales for Flowfold. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm going to go now to an email. This is from Dr. Brandon Giberson. He writes, I'm an emergency department physician. These are scary times. I wanted to give everyone a positive message to read today. Recently, my hospital asked for donations of N95 masks to help us keep up with the anticipated need in the midst of the COVID pandemic. I shared their post on my personal Facebook page. Today in the mail, I received two sets of brand new N95 masks shipped overnight to me from my second grade teacher, the same lady who taught me how to write a complete sentence and to count by fives is now helping to keep me safe 25 years later. I love the little community I grew up in. Thanks so much, Mrs. Wendy Honeywell Belanger. I'm sorry I misbehaved so much in class. So there we go. That just may be the email of the day. We're going to go to Jennifer calling from Bar Harbor. Hi, Jennifer. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm the executive director for the Bar Harbor Food Pantry, so I just wanted to call in. First, Good Shepherd Food Bank has done an amazing job at responding to everything that's been going on statewide to all of us partner agencies, and I just want to give them a big shout out. They're certainly making our jobs easier. And we also, at the pantry level, a lot of us have probably had to shift how we operate. We have an open shopping floor for our clients, and obviously we haven't been able to let them in. So now we've shifted to just skeleton staff of myself, my part-time staff, and a few board members, one to reduce the vector of volunteers coming in. So another great point, we rely heavily on volunteers, and we're no longer able to do that because we can't keep a 6-foot distance in our space. It's too small for that. And we've created an outside curb drive-by pickup area that we put all the food on for the people, and all of our clients are calling in and scheduling appointment times now, and we're pre-packing the boxes, and we're still trying to customize as best we can for their needs. We also are able to order produce, and we've dropped down one. They've dropped out a delivery day, so we're down to ordering just one day a week and trying to make sure we still have enough to last the whole week. But on our end, we're definitely seeing a massive increase of people. We've already registered 30 new households within a week. And I suspect that that number is just going to continue to increase. So I really appreciate what Aaron is saying. We're like, if you can help Good Shepherd, that's amazing. But if you can also help your local pantries, they're really going to need it right now.
Jennifer, what could people specifically do? You say that you have had to cut down on your volunteer hours because of the, you know, physical distancing. Do you want people to drop off food? I'm sure you'd like donations, but is it hard to buy the food right now with a donation?
So we purchase from Good Shepherd, so your dollar does go further if you donate monetary to us. But we also have the ability to order from Performance for Produce, and we've always had that in place. And we also order bulk food items from Associated Buyers, and then we repackage down into smaller amounts. So right now, we're still actually pretty good. There's some items that we can't get just because of how we do purchase. And those items are also things that are not really on the shelves right now, at least at our local Hannaford, as we try to catch up. But some people have been shopping on Amazon and sending it directly to us when it's like cereal or canned soups that they're able to buy from Costco or Sam's Club in bulk. And they can ship it right to us. So maybe your local pantry can do that as well. And as far as helping, we're still engaging volunteers in case of doing deliveries, because we do have a few people and clients that just aren't able to get to us since we've had to shift our operation hours. And so we've been utilizing our volunteers to do delivery, and we just have a protocol of, you know, leaving it on the person's doorstep, wearing gloves. We do have some of those homemade sewn masks that our communities made for us to distribute to volunteers to use. So that's kind of how we've been using our volunteers.
Well, Jennifer, thanks so much for calling in. That's Bar Harbor, who is the executive director of the Bar Harbor Food Pantry. And I'm also going to read an email. This is from another Aaron. Our organization is a regional food redistribution center with a mission to connect people in Piscataquis County with healthy sources of food. We are not a food pantry ourselves, but we are directly involved with helping food pantries and other food access services in their effort to get food to people in need. We are all talking about how to collectively handle a surge in demand for emergency food. I'm confident we can do it, but we need communities to understand that the solution is not just about pumping more food into the system. In order to serve more people, we also need to make sure we have enough people to distribute that food. Many of the volunteers working in pantries are older and have underlying health issues that put them at high risk for infection. And that's from Aaron Calloway at the Piscataquis Regional Food Center. And Aaron, I'm going to turn to you and say, It sounds like as we get into the long haul here, drivers, people who can deliver food, are going to be one of the things that people, that your clients really need.
Absolutely. And I just have to comment that both Jennifer Jones and Aaron Calloway, it's so great to hear their voices and names on air. They represent the best of our food network, and they're just so inspiring with the work that they're doing in their communities. And you're absolutely right. I think the getting food to people, that logistical challenge, we always say kind of day to day in our work, there is enough food here in our state and in our country to make sure everyone has access to enough nutritious food. It's just a matter of logistics. And right now, the logistics are harder than ever. And so really understanding what is needed in your community. We are tracking on the Good Shepherd Food Bank website. If you go to our COVID response page, you can see our updated listings of partner agencies and their current distribution methods and hours. I would suggest if you have a food pantry in your local community, go find them on social media, on Facebook, follow them, and you'll see people like Jennifer Jones from Bar Harbor posting regularly about what they need, if they need a driver that day, if they need more food. And you'll also see the really inspiring posts about how hard they're working behind the scenes. And important for all of us to remember that during this time of crisis, so many people are offering to help. And those food pantry workers and volunteers are the people who are doing this every day that we don't think about as often.
Well, go to Kate on Facebook. She writes, Mainers Together is a great resource for people who need help and people who are looking to help out and or donate. And that's the website, MainersTogether.com. Mary Alice, is that an organization you're familiar with?
It is one that we've recently come across. And it appears to be a person-to-person connection. So, you know, not necessarily like Good Shepherd or the Meals on Wheels programs or some others, but a great way for folks who may not have family around or something like that to at least contemplate how to get some assistance. There are other places that are also going to be looking for drivers. The Meals on Wheels programs or Meals for Me or any of those sorts of things have also depended on a lot of retirees. And so thinking about how folks can fill those gaps as the summer comes on for them. Or as we get into growing season, the Cooperative Extension is and others have usually done the Grow a Row. In order to, it's not an immediate sort of thing, but for folks to keep in mind that there will be other ways as we move along.
All right. We're going to go to Jennifer, who's calling with the Maine Association of Nonprofits. Jennifer, we're nearing the end of the hour, so if you could be brief, that would be great.
Yeah. Hi, Jen. Jennifer Hutchins. Yeah, I just wanted to pitch in that we have a COVID page over at the Maine Association of Nonprofits that's specifically for helping nonprofits understand how this impacts them. And we've started a blog series that is featuring all the great innovation that's going on in the nonprofit community. And also on our COVID pages, we're asking people to send in what they're doing, and we'll be sharing that out via all of our social media and blogs and that sort of thing. So I wanted to make sure that we're here. We see the great work that's happening by nonprofits all over the state. It's really inspiring, and we want to make sure we can be a resource to get those stories out.
Great. And can you tell us the name of the website?
Yeah, it's nonprofitmaine.org/COVID-19, COVID-19.
All right. Well, Jennifer, thanks so much for calling in. Jennifer Hutchins with the Maine Association of Nonprofits. As we come to the end of this hour, Mary Alice, I'm wondering if you have some final thoughts about people out there interested in volunteering right now.
So I think the final thought is to reach out. If you want to use Facebook, great. Also, as I mentioned before, there are already organizations who have posted all their needs and on the United Way sites, and you can communicate directly with them. They're keeping them up to date, and that lets you know what's right within your reach that could use your assistance.
All right, and for you too, Erin Fogg.
Sure. I will say, I think nonprofits sometimes can be shy about asking for funds. But in a time like this, all nonprofits, even if they say they need drivers and volunteers and food, they also need dollars. And they'll mean so much right now. So if you can support a local nonprofit who's doing relief work in your community, please do so.
All right. Well, we are at the halfway point for today's program. Before we take a quick break, I'd like to thank our guests for this hour, Erin Fogg, whose voice you just heard. She's Vice President of Development and Communications with the Good Shepherd Food Bank, and Mary Alice Crofton, the Executive Director of Volunteer Maine. When we return, we will talk more about how people in Maine are helping each other face the challenges brought on by coronavirus. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a news update.
Major support of Maine Calling's special coverage is provided by Eastern Basements, a division of Eastern Mold Remediation, a Maine-owned company committed to the health and wellness of their employees and customers. Eastern Basements believes a well-informed public is key to keeping Maine's communities safe and healthy. EasternBasements.com. You're listening to listener-supported Maine Public Radio, WMEA Portland 90.1, WMEH Bangor 90.9, WMEW Waterville 91.3, WMED Calais 89.7, WMEM Presque Isle 106.1, WMEF Fort Kent 106.5, WMEP Camden 90.5. You can also find us on the web at mainepublic.org. Maine Public was founded by the University of Maine System and Colby, Bates, and Bowdoin Colleges.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The U.S. House of Representatives is sending a more than $2 trillion coronavirus relief package to President Donald Trump for his signature. NPR's Gloria Grisales reports the House approved the measure in a voice vote.
House lawmakers spread out through the chamber and its public galleries under new social distancing guidelines. They voted with a series of A's, but at least one member voted no. That member, Kentucky Republican Thomas Massie, asked for a roll call vote but was shouted down. The House is on track to send the measure to the president later today.
NPR's Gloria Grisales reporting. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin has said that most Americans should start receiving their one-time direct payments from the federal government within 3 weeks. He says most will get it through direct deposit. The payments, part of the $2 trillion stimulus package the president's preparing to sign, are being offered at an especially difficult time for our businesses that have closed and the employees who are out of work because of the social distancing measures. Last week, jobless claims reached unprecedented levels when more than 3 million people filed for unemployment insurance. The government's making it easier for people from foreign countries to get visas to work on farms in the U.S. despite the pandemic. We have more from NPR's Dan Charles.
Farms that grow fresh produce have been relying more and more on temporary workers from abroad, mostly Mexico. 250,000 foreign workers got temporary visas to work on U.S. farms last year. But U.S. consulates in Mexico have closed most of their visa operations. It hasn't stopped Mexicans who've worked in the U.S. before from renewing those visas, but it threatened to stop the flow of new farm workers. The State Department now says the farm worker program is a national security priority, and it will continue issuing new visas, too. It won't necessarily require an in-person interview before approving them. Farm groups and the U.S. Department of Agriculture praised the decision. Dan Charles, NPR News.
The Kremlin says a member of Russian President Vladimir Putin's administration has tested positive for the coronavirus. From Moscow, Charles Maines has details.
Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said the staff member had no contact with President Putin and insisted the news proved the efficacy of regular testing of COVID-19 inside the administration. The news came as cases of those infected with the coronavirus surged past the 1,000 mark, with 3 official reported deaths. Government critics insist lax testing suggests infection numbers are far higher. Epidemiologists here say they expect the contagion to peak in early April. After previously insisting his government had the coronavirus under control, Putin this week ordered additional measures to combat the contagion, most controversially, a paid week off of work starting Monday. that critics say falls far short of a quarantine and risks further spread of the disease. For NPR News, I'm Charles Maines in Moscow.
All major market indices are down 2.5% to 2.8%. This is NPR News.
It's 4 minutes after two. I'm Nora Flaherty with this Maine news. A Cumberland County man in his 80s is the first person in Maine to die from COVID-19. At a daily press briefing, Governor Janet Mills offered her condolences to the family and urged Mainers to continue to practice physical distancing.
Please, please stay away from other people. Stay home. Leave home only when absolutely necessary.
The Maine CDC says the state now has 168 confirmed cases of COVID-19. 30 people are hospitalized and 24 have recovered. Meanwhile, Maine CDC Director Nirav Shah continues to sound the alarm over the shortage of personal protective equipment. Shah told reporters today that based on some of the reports from individual hospitals,
right now, with respect to PPE, we've got an umbrella and we're in a hurricane.
The federal government's been releasing some PPE from its strategic national stockpile, but Shah says the feds have indicated that Maine might not receive its full allotment because the supply was being diverted to harder hit states. At least 16 healthcare workers are among the state's 168 confirmed cases of COVID-19. And Maine has enacted a law that supporters say will expand access to broadband in underserved parts of the state. The proposal from Democratic Senator Shenna Bellows is intended to make it easier for communities to get planning grants for broadband. Maine Democrats say the changes will also make it easier to identify parts of Maine where the state needs to invest in better access to high-speed internet. Democratic Governor Janet Mills signed the proposal into law on March 18th. In weather this afternoon, rain and snow showers drying up north and down east, partly clearing west and central, sunny south, windy, highs in the mid-30s to mid-50s.
Stations. Other contributors include Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital markets solutions. Learn more at RaymondJames.com. And Americans for the Arts.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Calling. This hour, we continue our conversation about the different ways to help others during this crisis. Joining me, Courtney Yeager, who is Executive Director of United Way of Kennebec Valley, and Mark Swan, Executive Director of Preble Street. As always, we want to hear from you. Share your questions, your ideas, your stories about people helping each other, and ways to offer support or volunteer. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Mark and Courtney, thank you both so much for joining us for the second hour of this program today. And Mark, I want to start with you. You know, everything we're hearing, including from Governor Mills just now, people are telling people, stay at home, don't see other people. That is not possible for many of the people you serve where their home is a shelter. How are you and how are other shelters around the state handling this crisis?
Well, thanks for having me, Jennifer. I think I actually just got off the phone with a statewide call of several shelters around Maine, and we're all struggling. You know, it's really pushing us all to our limits, as you say. All of the directives, you know, the public health directives around, you know, being isolated and social distancing and staying home are just not options for people who are homeless. And a lot of the shelters in the state, like around the country, are very crowded shelters. And, you know, the idea of 6 feet social distancing is impossible at those shelters. So it's been really, really challenging. At the same time, we need staff to keep our shelters open, and we need volunteers to support the efforts that we're all undertaking. So it's about as challenging as a period as I've ever seen in my career.
And I know Preble Street depends on really quite a few volunteers, legions of volunteers. Aren't they still coming now? Are you still seeing the volunteers that you have traditionally?
Many are still coming. We've got just wonderful people who, you know, really committed to us. We've also had people reach out to us and, you know, and feel, you know, actually feel terrible that they don't feel they can volunteer anymore because of, you know, their own health and safety. And we get that, and we understand that, and we respect that. But we've also had a little bit of a surge of some new volunteers, too, people, I think, who have lost their jobs and have some time and want to give back, or college students who ended up, you know, being home a lot earlier than they expected, and maybe they're not working either. So we have seen some new people show up and offer to help, and thank God, because we really need it, you know, particularly at our food programs. I mean, at one of our centers, we have we serve over 1,000 meals a day, and we can't do that without volunteers. So we've made some changes. We're now going, everything is to-go meals, all of it. You know, this whole thing, we were seeing 300 to 400 people for each meal coming into that one center, the resource center. And so we're now we're providing meals at the city's Oxford Street shelter, so people from the shelter don't have to come to the resource center. We're providing meals at several sober houses around town. Just starting yesterday, I think the Y came and picked up some meals. So, you know, we're encouraging that with different organizations that, you know, whose clients rely on us for food, to instead come and pick up the meals and bring them back to those shelters or those group homes or whatever. But even with that, we still have just about every meal, we still are having about 100 people show up as individuals for the takeout meals. Most of those are people who are unsheltered. So we're still doing, you know, 350 meals for each meal. So over 1,000 meals a day.
Mark, how are you protecting the volunteers? How are they protecting themselves? Are they wearing gloves and masks?
We have gloves, and we're trying to really, really be clear on the social distancing. We've got hygiene stations everywhere and hand washing stations, and we're really trying to direct people following all of the CDC guidelines as best we can. And I think that's worked. I think people have feel comfortable in our space. And if they don't, you know, we do understand that. But we're doing all we can to keep everybody safe. I mean, it's not, you know, the whole issue of you know, people congregating. It's you know, it's not just that our volunteers need to be safe from our clients. It's our clients need to be safe from our volunteers as well, because, you know, this virus knows no socioeconomic boundaries. That's for sure. So we've asked volunteers who've been traveling to not volunteer with us, or if they're, you know, if they've been in any hot spots. So the protection is really for everybody at Preble Street.
All right. I want to turn to Courtney Yeager now with the United Way. Courtney, I don't know if you heard the first hour of this program, but Mary Alice Crofton really called out the United Way for doing some wonderful work of coordinating, being a clearinghouse for all the organizations that need volunteers and connecting them right now. Tell us what you're experiencing. Has there been a surge in both need for help as well as offers to help?
Thank you so much for having me today, and I want to thank Mary Alice, who is a good friend of United Way, for giving us that shout-out earlier in the program. United Way as an organization across the country has a 130-year history of really being on the front lines of community problems, and that's both everyday issues and crises. So in times of a natural disaster, we've always ensured that first responders are acting quickly. And we've always tried to put out critical information to the public about volunteering and things like that. So the question for me is, why would that be any different now that we're facing a health disaster rather than just a natural disaster? So at the United Way of Maine level, and there are 9 of us in the state, we are working hard to help coordinate interested volunteers at the local level. And as Mary Alice pointed out, we have a statewide website that you can check. It is unitedwaysofmaine.org. And if you click volunteer, you can find opportunities that are really in your own backyard. And many of our local United Way sites also have pages or volunteer opportunities that are specific to helping during this pandemic. So I would say in terms of volunteer needs, we are definitely seeing an increase among our partner programs. My United Way is located in the center of the state, serving southern Kennebec County, and we are primarily hearing from our food banks and our Meals on Wheels programs that they were struggling, especially at the beginning of this. This time last week, they were having a really tough time finding volunteers because the majority of their typical volunteers were in that 60-plus age cohort. And understandably, many of those folks wanted to kind of step back or were being asked to step back by the food bank's boards from their typical duties. So this was an opportunity, really, for others in our community to step up. And we at United Ways across the state have been trying to serve as that clearinghouse through our Volunteer Me portal, which is statewide.
And I understand you're also on the state's donations coordination team. Tell me what that is and what you're seeing right now.
So the donations coordinations team is something that really involves several different sectors across the state. So Maine CDC serves on it, Volunteer Maine, 211, which is another program we should talk about at some point on this hour. There are a lot of really good folks across the state who are doing important things, and there's a donation of PPE needs, certainly, as we've talked about a little bit. But there's also, you know, the financial donations, where should those go? So there's kind of two sides of this story, and people want to help, and we're just trying to pull all of our resources and minds together to figure out what's the best way to roll out donations and to accept those donations in a time of crisis where everything is changing hour by hour.
All right. Mark, I want to ask you, I understand that Preble Street is building a new temporary shelter in Portland. Tell me about that and what it'll be used for.
Well, I wish I had more I could talk about related to that, because a lot of people are working hard to keep people safe, and you know, hopefully a new shelter will open soon, but there's nothing definitive at this point.
Okay. All righty. Let's see here. We're going to go, if I grab the right mouse, to Wendy in Addison. Hi, Wendy. Go ahead.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. Hold on. lost the connection. I'm Wendy Harrington. I work with the Maine Seacoast Mission up in Sherryfield, Maine, and I wanted to share a little bit about the programs that we're doing and the need that we have for volunteers. The mission works with people in Washington and Hancock counties and the islands. We have telemedicine, island services on the Sunbeam. We have a large after-school program and a number of food after-school program and a number of food programs, including a pantry, backpack programs, and government commodities. And like everyone else, all these programs have had to change because of the virus. So we've changed the way we're working with them, and we see an increased need for using our neighbors and asking them to help us with the work that we're doing to help provide food and other services. And the other thing that we're really working on is providing a lifeline to the people who are hunkering down or sheltering in place. We've seen, like the other food pantries, we've seen a large increase in the number of people asking for help. We're working, as they are, very hard to distribute the food in the most effective and safe way to make sure no one gets or goes hungry. And so we have a drive-through distribution model at our parking lot in Sherryfield, where people get that friendly hello from staff and volunteers in addition to a box of food. But many people, including our seniors, need a home delivery. And this is one area that we're going to need help in filling all the requests that are coming in for a home delivery. That has increased tremendously in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, this is what we're hearing from many others, is that is going to probably be what you need as a delivery. Thank you so much, Wendy, for calling in from the Maine Seacoast Mission. Yeah, we have an email here from Janice. I'm elderly, living alone, staying at home, and I'm fine. I'd like to make financial contributions to social services agencies directly, helping people who are really in need. What agencies most need support? Courtney, I know this is a hard question to answer.
Well, it's a pretty easy one, I think, for United Ways to answer at this time, because all the United Ways in the state of Maine have set up their own localized opportunity or COVID-19 fund that
we're really opening this up to the public to accept donations and know that 100% of those donations are going right back out into the community. There's no overhead cost. What we're doing, though, which is something that would be hard for an individual to do on his or her own, we are able to really vet these programs. Nonprofits are applying directly to our United Ways, and then we're trying to get the money out the door as fast as we possibly can. So my board, for example, met yesterday to review a handful of applications we received, and as soon as yesterday afternoon, we've got checks in the mail to these programs to make sure they're getting the help they need. So every United Way is supporting different programs, but I think I can say with pretty much certainty that at the beginning of this, we're really focusing on those basic needs programs that are helping folks get to their food bank support, PPE equipment that would be available to folks. So this is a really good resource for people who aren't sure or don't want to make a decision to just support one program. I would say feel free to put it in the hands of United Ways that have been doing this work for a long time and working with these essential programs in the community.
Tori on Facebook is asking, will you please talk about the needle exchange closing? Mark Swan, I know this is a City of Portland program, but I'm just wondering if you know about this and know of resources in place of it.
I do know a little bit about this, and obviously things are changing rapidly, but my understanding, and this is probably 48 hours old or so, is that there's a very limited, it has closed, as you said, but there's a very limited outreach effort being made. I can get the information to you, Jennifer, exactly where and when. I think there's some trained volunteer leadership of the Needle Exchange who have moved to really a kind of a street outreach positioning to be available and accessible for people. But I'll send you the information specifically so you can post it.
Okay, great. And that's on our Facebook page. Tweet, how is Preble Street finding food when there's been panic buying everywhere? Are there still donations from the grocery chains?
Yes, there definitely are still donations from the grocery chains. Trader Joe's has been a big help to us, as usual, and Hannaford's is always there for us. A lot of that work, particularly with Hannaford, goes through Good Shepherd Food Bank, the statewide food bank, which we're very appreciative of, and they've got some kind of emergency funds in place that they're putting to use and helping soup kitchens and pantries around the state. But it's been very day-to-day. I mean, last week we had a surge in food donations, sadly, from restaurants that were closing. And, you know, they were going to have all the spoiled food. So last week we kind of had that surge, which was wonderful, and some schools as well. But now that's dying off. So it's just a day-to-day thing. I was shocked. You know, I've been, you know, there's an inside joke among soup kitchen people all over the country about bread. You always have too much bread. Soup kitchens get so much donated bread that we often have too much and have to get rid of it because it goes stale. And 2 days ago, for the first time in 40 years at Preble Street, we had to buy bread. Because for a brief day or two, that completely dried up for us. So we are worried about moving forward, not just because, you know, the world is changing so rapidly and people are, as the caller said, kind of buying up and hoarding a lot of food. But we also think our numbers are going to increase, particularly at our food pantry, if not the soup kitchen. We've already seen that this week, where people are coming for food boxes to take home. So it's not people who are homeless. It's people who need, you know, food help in their homes. And we've seen an increase this week, you know, almost doubled what we saw the week before. And I was interviewed a couple days ago by a reporter, and he told me his girlfriend has volunteered with us for 2 years. She's now lost her job, and they were talking about becoming clients of Preble Street and coming to need food boxes because, you know, bartenders and restaurant workers.
Wow, Mark.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
The long term, and our colleagues around the country have really mapped this out pretty stark terms about the long term food needs are only going to go up and up and up with the unemployment situation.
I'm cutting over now to Dan Abbott, who is calling in from Southern Maine Community College. Dan Abbott teaches in the Architectural and Engineering Design Department. Dan, I understand you've been incredibly busy because of a device that you're working on. Tell us about how this came to be. How did it come to be that you and others with you have created a device that may be able to help patients at Maine Medical Center?
Hi, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm good.
Well, Heather Higgins is a chair of our respiratory therapy department at SMCC, wrote me an email on Sunday and said, I hear you have a 3D printer. Some of my colleagues and I, the therapists at Maine Medical Center, have been brainstorming about whether it would be possible to connect multiple clients and multiple patients to a single machine. She knew that people had done it, but she wasn't able to find a device that would let them do it and wondered if I'd be willing to get involved with them. So we had a conference call on Monday. I had some designs. I wasn't able to find anything online that was very suitable in the sense that most of the things online were pieces pulled from different places and kind of put together. And so what they really wanted was a single lightweight device that could plug in and disconnect the same way they do all the other ports on a ventilator. Then that had a nice smooth passage on the inside, and that could easily be used. It didn't have and was lightweight, so it didn't hang down all the hoses. So I came up with a design that they liked, and then printed one up on a printer that we have. And one of the things I want to say is when people hear 3D printing, they think that they can print stuff on any 3D printer, but this is a very specialized medical grade 3D printer that uses a liquid resin. It's not the kind of printer that people have that uses a wire of plastic. And so I've just been fielding many, many calls from people and emails saying, I can print this at home, but the fact is, unless you have a Form Labs Form 2 or Form 3 printer that prints a resin-based part, everything else I tried failed. And so anyway, that's how it came about. I put one together, and one of the respiratory therapists took it over and hooked it up to test it for air pressure. It held. I made another one. He put it together and put together essentially a simulation with four patients using simulators for each of the patients. And the whole purpose of that at that stage was just to find out, will this thing hold air over a long period of time before they were going to move on for the other much more complex stuff. So really all I did was design a very simple five-port plumbing fixture that was designed specifically to work for the tubing that they have and that met their concerns. And then they were plugging it in, and initially just, is it going to hold air? And over the last 40-some hours, it has been perfect in holding air. So once I knew that we could do it, I started printing them and realized that it was going to take a long time since that printer that I have takes 5 hours. I'm sorry. We'll print five parts in 14 hours. So,
oh, gosh.
Yeah, so that's why, you know, Monica is the one who got this going on her Facebook page. I knew I needed more capacity.
So Monica is Monica Wood, your wife, and she put a call out and said, anybody else have, are there any other printers like this in the state, right?
Correct. That's exactly what she did. And because she has such a large Facebook following, there was a huge response, and huge as in overwhelming. I'm laughing just because I feel like all I've done is check emails lately for people making offers. But anyway, so, you know, I'm printing them. And as far as capacity goes, well, yesterday morning I came in and the one printer I had an error message and hadn't printed the parts.
Oh.
So I was like, what am I going to do now? But by the end of the day, I had two people printing things in their own printers outside. I've got three other printers identified externally if we need them. And the system decided that every campus should have one of these. So let's just buy one for every campus and give them all to you for now. So, you know, they're in academic use, but for now we're going to just group them together. So I've got, in fact, I just came in here a little out of breath because I'm setting up the ones that just got delivered. I just had three new printers delivered about an hour ago. So I'm going to set those up. So my capacity here has increased dramatically, and then I've got other people printing as well.
Oh, my gosh, that's so wonderful. The device, I understand, is called a Starfish, and I want to let you go as soon as possible. But do you have any sense when it will be put to use?
I don't. I'm hoping it never does, of course. The thing is, right now, Maine Medical Center, this is where the technicians happen to be. But really, at this point, all I did was gave them a device that doesn't leak. At this point, they're doing testing that goes much more complex, goes well beyond anything that I'm involved with. And obviously, they have to be very cautious about giving the okay to something like this, particularly this particular procedure, which apparently is quite controversial. So I don't have any idea. They might decide after doing all the testing that they're just not going to do it, and then these devices are worthless. The reason I'm doing this, though, and the reason I was so urgent about it, is that if they decide they do need them in an emergency and then turn to me and say, can you give us some, I just can't afford to have them wait 14 hours to get five of them. So I'm right now just printing stockpiles of the things, and if we throw them away, we throw them away. But our system president is all on board with it, and we're just really doing this. So if something really goes wrong, we'll be supplied. We'll have a supply of these things. And if they suddenly say, you know, I really do need those, I can just give them a box instead of saying I'll be back to you in 2 days.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for taking time a few minutes out to talk to us. You can get back to setting up your machines now, your printers. That's Dan Abbott. He's with Southern Maine Community College in the Architecture and Engineering Design Department. The device he's developed is called the Starfish, and it is designed to help ventilators, if I got that right, in emergency rooms if this crisis gets even worse for hospitals.
That's correct. It was the technicians that are therapists who are testing this that dubbed it the Starfish. It just looks like a starfish because, of course, it's five ports, and they're equally distributed. So we got the design right out of nature. But, yeah, that's it. It's for ventilators. And, again, it would have to be a dire emergency. Nobody thinks this is a good way to use a respirator or a ventilator. I'm sorry. Clearly, it's just a question of being prepared. And I really admire the folks over there in the front line who said, well, let's just see if this is feasible and at least find out, can we get a device of some kind? And then we'll go from there. But I've got high hopes for it, but I have no idea. I'm just waiting like everyone else to see what happens with the tests.
Well, thank you so much, Dan. So inspirational. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. Stay with us.
Major support of Maine Calling's special coverage is provided by Northeastern University, announcing the Rue Institute in Portland, a new model for graduate learning and research. Visit rouxinstitute.northeastern.edu. And the Coastal Dog in Edgecombe, Maine, dedicated to offering a home away from home for dogs for overnight or daycare. Learn more at thecoastaldog.net.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, I'll talk with our Washington correspondent about the many political battles being waged in the Capitol over how to deal with the new coronavirus.
You couldn't imagine a president personalizing a crisis with a virus, but somehow that's where we are.
Susan Glasser, next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
And that's tomorrow afternoon at 2 and again Sunday evening at 11 here on Maine Public Radio. If you're a teacher or educator here in Maine, or perhaps homeschooling, there's a valuable free educational resource you may be interested in. Our PBS Learning Media Service contains extensive digital and classroom-ready resources for K-12. This educational resource is aligned with Common Core and national standards. Please look for PBS Learning Media online at mainepublic.org under the Education dropdown.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Calling. Today we're talking about ways to help others. We're looking for your ideas and we're hearing about volunteer opportunities. On the line with us right now, Courtney Yeager with United Way of Kennebec Valley and Mark Swan with Preble Street. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Let's see here. As soon as I click, I just grabbed the wrong mouse. Here we go. Calling in now, Marie McCarthy. She is with L.L. Bean. Hi, Marie. Thanks for calling in.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
I understand that L.L. Bean has closed its stores, which is a big deal, but that many people are now helping with relief efforts. Tell me about what's going on behind the scenes at L.L. Bean right now.
For sure. There's two primary things that we're engaged in right now. We've partnered with Good Shepherd Food Bank within our fulfillment center to help them deliver food out to folks in the state of Maine. We've had conversation with them over the last week or so to get set up with that, which is great. So we're shipping out about 15,000 boxes a week. And we're packing it up for them, and they're taking care of the transportation on our behalf, which is great and really pleased to be in partnership with them. And then in a different front within our manufacturing facility, we got a call from Maine Health last Friday asking if we could maybe help to try and come up with some creative ways to make masks. So we are working with our existing materials, things like dog bed liners, to see if we can create, ideally, we'd love to be able to create surgical masks for them, but we're starting with our ability to try and make a sneeze mask. And so by about Tuesday of this week, we had some prototypes and samples sent to them, and now we're gearing up for production. So we'll start more full-fledged on Monday with our stitchers working to start creating those masks.
How's it going so far?
So far, it's been good. I'm really pleased with the team that's addressed this because they just hopped on it right away. We actually had an employee in our team come forth with an idea about a week ago. So our team was already prototyping some concepts before Maine Health called. So they had a bit of a running head start, and we've just been getting our stitchers prepped and prepared over the last day or so. And then our plan next week is to start going to all the production went well today. And the plan is to go to a first and second shift operation and, as necessary, work 7 days a week if we needed to across that time period to produce as much as we can, as fast as we can for them.
It must be satisfying for you and for the people working at L.L. Bean to be able to be part of this effort.
Yeah, it feels like it's so aligned with what our values have been about as an organization for over 100 years. I know it's very inspiring for a lot of the folks inside the organization. I've worked here for a long time, too. It just feels like it's what we've always been about.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. That's Marie McCarthy with L.L. Bean. I really appreciate you taking the time to call in today. I want to go to an email here. My wife and I have brought some gift certificates to restaurants with the promise that we won't be using them until better times. Also, until 2 days ago, I didn't know what an N95 mask was. I found an image and realized I had a box of these in my workshop. We've donated 13 masks and some unused safety glasses, and I would recommend that others see if they have similar items on hand. So, there we go. Another person email from Woody who says, my high school staff purchases and distributes dozens of gift cards for food, gas, and local businesses during the winter holiday season. A recent news article suggested the same model to support both those in need and local businesses. My school is doing it again now. We also accept food donations. People can send gift cards through the mail to local schools to maintain social distancing. In extremely rural Maine with widespread food insecurity, every little bit helps. We're going to go to Clay, who's calling from Anson. Hi, Clay. Go ahead.
Hi there. I'm a musician, and I actually started a campaign on social media last week promoting my new album, but donating all of the money made from album sales to Preble Street. And I've decided to continue the campaign another week. And I just wanted to let people know if they want some local music and knowing their money will go to Preble Street, they can look up my music on Bandcamp. I'll put a link up on your Facebook page too, but my name is Clay Camaro, and that's C-A-M-E-R-O, Clay Camaro.
Wow. Mark Swan.
Thank you, Clay. That's wonderful. That's so cool. I appreciate it a lot.
Thank you, Clay, and feel free to post anything on the Maine Calling Facebook page. We're going to go to Marfine calling from Portland. Hi, Marfine. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to lift up, it's not necessarily a volunteer opportunity, but it's an opportunity to be aware of how Black and brown people are disproportionately impacted by the perceptions around viruses, especially with certain language coming out of the White House. Just a story about that. I was at the grocery store last week, and a woman of color came up to me to ask where she could find this one item. And afterwards, she told me that she had asked two previous people in the same store, and both of them just walked off without saying anything. So even though we're supposed to be practicing social distancing, I don't think that's licensed for people to be unkind. And then the other part of it too is Black and brown owned businesses are specifically disproportionately impacted by this. And I would suggest along the lines of what the other caller said in terms of gift cards and online purchases. Of course, not all Black and brown businesses have that option, so you might have to give them a call and see how you can help.
All right, Marfine, thanks so much for your call. We're going to move to AMK calling from Westbrook. Hi, AMK, go ahead.
Hello there. Thank you for taking my call. Just a question in response to the capacity at the shelters for people to be there and be 6 feet apart. Have we not looked into the idea of taking over the expo again and possibly now USM's gymnasium, considering we did that when we had the immigrant surge, and set up beds and be able to give them the space they need?
Thanks for the question. Mark?
Yeah, there's a group working right now, actually, exploring options and looking at, you know, government buildings and facilities and places like you're describing. So, again, I'm hoping some things come together, you know, in the next day or so that we can start to, you know, get open. As the caller said, you know, and again, I was just on a state call before this, so many homeless shelters in the state were not built to be shelters. And they've kind of grown organically, and many of them have gotten more crowded and more crowded and more crowded. And that's certainly the case here in Portland. So this effort to create a new space is specifically to do what the caller suggested, to have people at least 6 feet apart. Preble Street, we operate two shelters now that were built to be shelters. One is our Joe Chrysler teen shelters for kids age 12 to 21, and the other is our Florence House women's shelter. So we have, every night we've got 64 people in these two shelters, but because it was built as a shelter, we have some options and more space than most shelters around the state. So in those shelters, we are doing the social distancing that is being requested, but many other places don't have that, you know, ability, despite the best intent, despite wanting to. So that's why this effort is underway, to try to find another space. So hopefully we'll have some news very, very soon about that.
AMK, thanks so much for calling in. It is time for another quick break. When we come back, some more of your thoughts about how we can all chip in and help. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Major support of Maine Calling's special coverage is provided by St. Mary's Health System Orthopedics, helping patients live their best lives in motion. Online at findabonedoctorme.org. And Maine Farmland Trust, growing a bright future for farming and for Maine. Dig in at mainfarmlandtrust.org.
COVID-19 has changed daily life in the United States, and with news breaking by the hour, it can be hard to stay up to date. I'm Michelle Martin. Join us every weekday for a new live conversation about the disease, what you need to know, what's coming next, and we will answer your questions. The National Conversation with All Things Considered from NPR News.
And that's weeknights at 9 here on Maine Public Radio. Many of your favorite Maine Public Television programs are available on our video on-demand service. And if you're in the mood for binge-watching or finding something that was broadcast several weeks ago, you'll want to have access to Passport. It's sort of like a public television Netflix service. Passport is available to all Maine Public supporters who are monthly Evergreen contributors. You'll find more information at mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today we're talking about ways to help in Maine. Joining me, Courtney Yeager with United Way of Kennebec Valley and Mark Swan with Preble Street. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We're going to go to Marty in Maine. Hi, Marty. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you so much for this program. It's been very, very helpful. I'm going to offer something that sounds a little bit backwards. Instead of one person trying to help many, there are many people out there who can help others. I've been active in the recovery community for over 25 years. And one of the hardest things to deal with is isolation, the sense of loneliness that comes with the disease. And for those who are newly starting out, it's amazingly difficult, just with normal social interaction, never mind with the physical distancing that's being recommended. So I have a couple of suggestions. One is, there are online meetings and phone meetings that are being made available in these circumstances for those meetings that are not physically being held anymore, and resources are available online at AA.org. There's click in a couple of places, and there's an online listing of resources. Separately, a big part of recovery is somebody who has worked through the program, found sobriety, and passing it on to someone else. It keeps it green for me. I could forget how bad it used to be. If somebody stepped away from the program for a while or is new or doesn't know what to do, if you have a phone number, call that person. You will help them more than they are helping you. It helps them to remember what it was like and to see that their pains and struggles have value today to help somebody else who's getting started. Thank you.
Marty, thank you so much for that call. I really appreciate it. Mark or Courtney, any thoughts on what Marty has to say?
I would just jump in. I think that's a really valid point. I appreciate you, Marty, bringing up the recovery community because, like so many different factions and groups in Maine, you know, we really need to be thinking about everybody right now. And that's a really important perspective you're bringing to the table. I would agree for all of our communities, we really need to be checking on families and friends, having gatherings via Zoom or FaceTime, calling your neighbors to see if they need anything, reaching out to the people who really mean something to you. You know, that is something that sounds so basic, but it's really, really essential right now.
Marty, thank you for your call. We're going to go to an email from Genev. I'm a professional Portuguese and Spanish interpreter with decades of experience. I want to offer my interpreting services via phone or video for free to help people who are supporting and working with Mainers from Angola in our communities. I know there are Portuguese-speaking people in Maine who can't ask questions, get vital information that they can understand, or communicate what they need in various contexts. Who are the people and organizations that have the most need for my skills? How can I communicate my availability to them? Do you know, Mark Swan, the answer to this question?
I would recommend that she reach out to either Catholic Charities, which, you know, runs a very robust interpreter service, or 211, which is the statewide info and referral network for human services. So I would think between those two, she might be able to hook up and connect with somebody.
Okay. We have an email from Peggy. Here's an invaluable, comprehensive resource for anyone who has access to a computer. Maine Coronavirus Community Assistance is a Facebook group composed of Mainers helping Mainers. Because it has grown exponentially overnight, it is now divided into subsections such as assistance needed, assistance provided, volunteers needed, homelessness, employment, multilingual assistance, and so forth, as well as divisions by county to help you find your locale. In your locale, it's person to person and expertly moderated. I've already volunteered twice. Hope folks find this helpful. So that may be another place for you to turn, Genev, to the Maine Coronavirus Community Assistance Facebook group. Thank you, Peggy, for sending that in. We're going to go to Todd, who's calling you from South Portland. Hi, Todd. Go ahead.
Hi there. Yes, I'm a member of the Maine chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, and I just wanted your listeners to be aware of a rapid response mutual aid program we are currently offering. If people visit southernmainedsa.org, they will be brought to a page where they could either, one, offer non-monetary support for people in need, two, donate funds, which will directly go to people in need, or three, they can request aid as well or assistance if that is what they need. Again, I do want to emphasize that this is not a long-term or medium-term solution that we are offering, but merely a short-term rapid response relief program that helps people bridge the gap for a week or two while they try to figure things out.
All right. Well, Todd, thanks so much for calling in. We're going to go to an email from Anna. Schools are closed across the state, and more than 80,000 Maine children rely on school meals every day. Many schools are continuing to feed kids school breakfast and school lunch through delivery on school buses and at drive-through meal sites and need financial help to continue this work. One way to support this work is to donate to Full plates potentials, excuse me, full plates, full potentials emergency fund for school closure at fullplates.org. All donations will go to support Maine schools and nonprofit efforts to get meals to kids during school closures. Mark and Courtney, are you all familiar with this organization, fullplates.org?
Very well. Yeah, it's a great organization. I would encourage people to support their efforts for sure. And you know, Good Shepherd Food Bank is another statewide organization that, you know, is a big help to the anti-hunger organizations. And, you know, like Courtney was saying earlier, in terms of financial contributions, you know, United Way is another important source for all the efforts we're talking about. And just in general, and certainly I'm biased and I'm in the weeds big time, but when I'm talking to my peers around the state, the shelters and the food pantries are really, really hurting and really concerned about their ability to meet their mission. So, you know, whether it's Preble Street or Milestone or Through These Doors here in Portland, those are the three private nonprofits that run shelters here. But, you know, Tedford in Brunswick or New Beginnings in Lewiston or Shaw House in Bangor, I mean, you know, Knox County Homeless Coalition, there's in every part, you know, almost every corner of the state, there are people trying valiantly to keep their shelters open and to feed our neighbors. So there's any number of good causes and good organizations out there. But Full Plates, Full Potential, certainly one of them. They're good people.
An email here from Mary Beth. I am a pre-K teacher in a public school here in Maine. We have contacted a couple area nursing care facilities, and we will be having our students draw or paint cheery pictures to send to their residents. The nursing homes will hold the mail for 24 hours and then distribute to the residents. Families feel like they can contribute, and the care facilities are looking forward to the children's art. Another great idea from Mary Beth. A caller who called earlier suggested if you're going to send a letter or a card to make sure and use a sponge when you seal that envelope and, you know, not spread germs that way. An email here from Patricia. The Game Loft in Belfast is reaching out to kids who are feeling isolated during this shelter-in-place period through postcards. Every day, we're reaching out to 250 kids in Waldo County. To get involved, please send cheery messages or jokes on a postcard, not a letter in an envelope, to the Game Loft, 78A Main Street, Belfast, 04915, or drop them off at the box behind the green door. The Game Loft staff will address the cards to kids, add stamps, and mail them. We are also serving grab-and-go meals for kids 7 days a week. Courtney, this is just an example of communities crafting very specific projects that are meaningful to their communities, individual areas knowing what the needs are in their neighborhoods.
Yeah, you know, so many times during this call, I've had a big smile growing on my face because just the ingenuity that's going into helping people at this horrible, horrible time in our country, in our world. And everybody's getting creative and finding ways to work together, to be collaborative, supporting each other in times of social isolation. Those examples, especially that the postcards, the mailings, I know that in our community, Big Brothers, Big Sisters of Mid-Maine has started a Pen Pals initiative to keep kids connected to their mentors. You know, there's a lot of kids who, yes, they might be struggling to get food now that schools are closed, and they might not have, you know, a super healthy home life to go home to. I also think about domestic violence programs. They're probably experiencing an uptick in calls because people are really stuck at home. So there's a lot of different ways I think we can continue to check on our neighbors and those who are most vulnerable in our community, and kids are definitely at the top of that list.
Debbie on Facebook writes, don't forget about cleaning products. We have an organization in the Belfast area called the Soap Closet. We have sent additional money to the food cupboards in the area to provide extra cleaning and soap products. And an email from Gail, I have a small business pet sitting and gardening in Kennebunk. Many of my clients have allowed me to hang on to their deposits towards a future trip. One of my gardening clients has prepaid me for work I will do once the weather allows. Well, these are generous gestures. This means that I will lose that income in the month that I perform that work. But at the moment, when I have no money coming in and have bills and a teen to feed, This is huge. So something to think about. Yeah. We're going to go to Tim, who's calling from Limerick. Hi, Tim. Go ahead.
Yes, I was just thinking that over in France they have a situation where they've made it a law that restaurants and grocery stores cannot throw their food away before it tries to go to a food pantry or some organization over there that that feeds the homeless and whatever. And so being a curious person and everything, I've looked in a lot of different dumpsters in my life, and there was one right here in Maine that I went in, and there was all kinds of food in there that wasn't even expired, that had been thrown away and everything. And so I brought it home and checked it out and everything, and made sure it was good and everything, and it was and everything. And some were even a month late, before due date. And it was in the dumpster. And when I went back to get some more at another occasion, I was thrown off the property, saying it was private property. So anyway, and the other thing, the person that called in about the loneliness, I wrote down that 83-year-old woman yesterday that called in and was alone and everything. I wrote down the word alone, and if you put another L and make it two words, it means all one. And I think alone can be made all one if we all work together.
Tim, thanks for your call. And Mark, thoughts about food waste? This is a real big issue. How is Preble Street, and how are other food organizations around the state trying to make sure that good food doesn't go to waste?
Well, that's always been, a part of our work, and it's a lot about putting the message out there and communicating and educating restaurants and grocery stores and whatnot. There is a Good Samaritan law here in Maine. So if you're donating with best intent any food product, and Lord forbid somebody gets sick from it, you're not going to be held liable. So with that law in hand, when we talk to people about making food donations to us, we've had great luck in doing so. So many restaurants here in Greater Portland support us, and like I mentioned earlier, the grocery stores and the bakeries, and the food service is huge in Portland, and they're by and large, very generous to Preble Street.
Absolutely, Courtney. Yeah,
this is on a separate note, but I would hate for the hour to lapse without us mentioning Red Cross. And as a country, we are experiencing a major blood shortage right now, and many blood drives have been canceled due to business closure, or I think just general fear about what's going on. But the Red Cross is taking extra precautions during this outbreak to keep donors safe, and there are still blood drives happening all throughout the state. So I would encourage everybody to just visit redcrossblood.org to find a site near you, because that's something we don't always think about in terms of donations, but there's certainly a huge need out there right now.
All right, a couple more emails here. David says, my good friend Luke Davidson at Maine Craft Distilling asked if I could help find the contact information to make donations to Maine's healthcare professionals, first responders, and volunteers across the state who are putting their lives and those of their families on the line. As you know, Luke and his team have been working tirelessly to manufacture their own version of craft-made hand sanitizer, doing this for the good of the community, and would like to channel donations from their efforts. And Mary writes, now that it looks like the federal government will be providing aid directly to most families, even with these checks, many people will be unable to meet basic needs for food and shelter. So I have a suggestion. If you are not in immediate need of that money you will receive, please consider donating some or all of it to an organization providing help during this difficult time. So I'm sure Courtney and Mark, you all say hear, hear to that.
Right. Yeah. When we had the Recovery Act, when was that, 12 years ago or so, in this country, and people, again, were given a kind of a bonus check that nobody expected, we had an awful lot of people just forward that along.
That's wonderful.
I really need it. Yeah.
Oh, well. Well, thank you so much. That's Mark Swan, Executive Director of Preble Street, and Courtney Yeager, Executive Director of the United Way of Kennebec Valley. Thank you to Lucy Suchek and the entire team, Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn, for producing this program. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.